So this is March 14th, 2012, my wife's birthday, who has given me a special furlough, special absence with leave to do this. So anyway, 2012, as I said, and I'm Rick Hansen, and I want to talk tonight about one of the seven factors of awakening in Buddhism. This one is energy. And to create a little bit of a context here, as you know, Buddhism, as well as many other teachings, including modern physics, is very much about processes and causes. So it really helps to appreciate what are the causes of both suffering and the causes of its end. That's the essence of the Four Noble Truths. And so if you think of it, the first noble truth is the problem, that of suffering, broadly defined. And then the other three of the Four Noble Truths, three-fourths of them, are about causal processes. The cause of suffering, the cause of the end of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering. So there are a variety of lists in Buddhism of causes that lead to good things. And one of the most central are the seven factors of awakening. And awakening is an ongoing process. I really like the Tibetan teaching, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening. Or in a everyday sense, from my experience certainly as a therapist, with time going this way, there's kind of a quantitative change for the better, and then a qualitative jump. Then quantitative change, then a qualitative jump. You know, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening. Or as another Tibetan saying has it, moments of enlightenment, many times a day, all right? And we do often get those little moments. They actually roll right under our nose, many of them, and part of practice is appreciating them more and more. So we have causes. And there are these seven factors of awakening. Awakening as a progressive process, and also awakening as the clearing away of the radiant consciousness and lovingness and happiness that is always already there, resting even most deeply in the ground that is really unconditioned. Okay, so these seven factors are mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture or bliss, tranquility, concentration, including samadhi states, non-ordinary states of absorption and insight, and last, equanimity. Those are the seven classic factors of awakening. And I've spoken already about the first two, mindfulness and investigation. And of course, we'll be undoubtedly exploring these in the months to come. But tonight I want to talk about the third one, energy, the Pali word for which is virya, V-I-R-I-Y-A, at least in English. So it's interesting that in Buddhism, which is very focused on not doing, it's focused on things like tranquility, or the ways in which so many things are described is in terms of not doing, not killing, not stealing, not abusing oneself or others with sexuality. That said, there is a real place for energy even in not doing. So, for example, a recurring description of a sincere practitioner at the beginning, the middle, and the end is, pardon me, one who is ardent, which means heartfelt, resolute, diligent, and mindful. Ardent is heartfelt. Ardor, like romantic love, ardor, or passion, artistic ardor, ardent is to be heartfelt and energized. Also, to read from a traditional chant, these are not the words of the Buddha, but this is a chant that's right now, I'm sure, it's being chanted somewhere probably in Asia. It's called the Reflections on Sharing Blessings. And if you've ever done a retreat in the Western Vipassana tradition, you may know this particular chant. I'll pull out a particular phrase. And the phrase is, where are we here? I'll do it like this. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing that goodness with all beings, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind. Until I realize Nibbana, or Nirvana, complete liberation, until I realize Nibbana, in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. Vigor, energy, again, and energy. It takes energy to not do things that are harmful. It takes energy to cultivate the good. And it takes energy to purify the mind. There's a teaching of the Buddha, which goes like this, avoid all evil, cultivate the good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. It's pretty simple, direct, isn't it? Right? Avoid all evil. Evil, broadly defined pragmatically, is that which causes harm for oneself or others. Cultivate good, purify the mind. It takes energy, vigor, ardency to do this. It also takes self-control. We have to exercise control over ourselves. And there's a teaching here from the Dhammapada, this collection of short sayings, a kind of extended poem. It goes like this. Irrigators regulate the rivers. Fletchers straighten the arrow shaft. Carpenters shape the wood. The wise control themselves. We have to do that skillfully. In the Zen saying, you know, as you've probably heard and heard me say, or heard me say, you know, we should be with our minds like the skillful rider of a horse, not too tight nor too loose a rein. But there is a quality of energy about this practice. We can't just be slothful. One of the five hindrances is sloth and torpor, you know, the opposite of energy. Okay. So what do we use the energy for? We use the energy toward the three fundamental intentions that are given in right intention, wise intention, the second of the noble elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. And by the way, with this teaching tonight, or any teaching, as the Buddha himself famously said, ehi pasiko, see for yourself if this rings true for you in your own heart and in your own life. Pragmatically, the Buddha always emphasized that the true test of something is not whether it sounds fancy or persuasive, but whether it works. Okay, so see if this works for you, this idea of energy toward the good. So what are the three intentions that are embedded in or given in wise or right intention in the Eightfold Path? The first is renunciation. It's the intention to relinquish, perhaps a better word than renunciate or renounce, to relinquish, to lay down. I had a spiritual teacher for a number of years, Adi Da, no longer alive, and he used a metaphor one time. He said, you know, if you're in the kitchen and there's this brown grocery bag stained with oil that flies are buzzing around and smells are coming out of it, when you recognize that, you know what to do with it. It's garbage. You take it out. You relinquish it. And renunciation is the relinquishment of those things, including particularly our grasping after problematic pleasures that cause harm for ourselves and others. And when we practice the intention, the noble intention of renunciation or relinquishment, we release a lesser happiness for the sake of a greater one. A little quote on that. Actually, I have two. Here we go. Any sensual bliss in the world, any heavenly bliss, isn't worth 1/16th of the bliss of the ending of craving. Renunciation is right front and center at basically half of craving. We crave or cling. I spoke about clinging last time. You know, we crave for the continuation of the pleasant and the growth of the pleasant. We crave the ending of the unpleasant. So here, they're talking about, you know, that there's no pleasure that's greater than the peace, the release, the relaxation, the ending of the suffering that's embedded in grasping after things that's present in renunciation, relinquishment. So we practice that. You know, we relinquish. It's easy to think about monastics who relinquish all worldly possessions. Here are some relinquishments, I think, that we can live with in a daily basis. Making other people wrong. sustaining an angry case about others in the mind, past the point that's useful. And that point is usually crossed very quickly, right? Within a few seconds, maybe a few minutes at most, there's a kind of recognition of what the issues are maybe and a kind of energization of oneself. After that, we're just pounding our foot with a hammer and complaining about how much it hurts. You know, there's a saying in AA, resentment is where I take poison and hope for you to die. You know? Okay. Metaphorically, hopefully. But anyway. Okay. So that's a relinquishment right there. Relinquishing getting caught up in politics these days, past the point that's useful. You know? Relinquishing overindulging certain pleasures that are not really any good for you or others. Eating, drinking, drugs, shopping, fascinations. These are relinquishments. Or, how about this one? Relinquishing beating yourself up. Relinquishing unfair standards for yourself. I had a guy in my office the other day who's a wonderful man. I know him quite well. Two young kids, strong husband, really a contributor, very generous with other people, very successful in the world. And he has an incredibly hard time receiving any acknowledgement because he says, whatever I do, I know I could do it better. So since it's not perfect, there's no point in feeling good about it. Well, I had to explain to him, nothing is ever perfect, so you might as well give up that. You know what I mean? We live in the world of imperfection. Actually, the third Zen patriarch had a wonderful sentence. He said, enlightenment is giving up anxiety over imperfection. That's profoundly deep, wise comment. So relinquishing unfair standards for ourselves. That's a form of renunciation too. So these are nice and useful kinds of renunciation, aren't they? Okay. So another quote about that. Thoroughly understanding the Dhamma, which is both thoroughly understanding reality and wisdom teachings about reality, and freed from longing through insight. There are these lovely phrases, aren't there? You could spend a week just reflecting on a phrase. Freed of longing through insight. The wise one, rid of all desire, is as calm as a pool unstirred by wind. You can just feel that, can't you? The pleasure of that kind of peacefulness. Oh. You know, the Buddha said, the highest happiness is peace. His teaching was not about a kind of blank or numbness when we get rid of desire or suffering, but the presence that can now move into that space of a deep, abiding, peaceful, happy lovingness, peaceful, loving, happiness, kind of all together. Conscious, peaceful, happy, loving, in any order you like, or all at once, even better. Okay, so that's the first of the three intentions. The second of the three is non-harming. We don't go around hurting beings, including ourselves. And let's see, I know I have a quote about that. Here we are. Slay anger and you will be happy. Slay anger and you will not sorrow. For the slaying of anger in all its forms, with its poisoned root and sweet sting, I'll come back to that, that is the slaying the noble ones praise. With anger slain, one weeps no more. The Buddha put a lot of emphasis on the abandoning of ill will. And ill will shows up in lots of ways. Obviously, it shows up in terrible ways in the world at large. Terrible violence, terrible revenge, terrible brutality. It shows up in smaller ways in daily life. For example, I actually gave a little talk recently about how the brain lights up in its pleasure centers when bad things happen to people we don't like. You know, that's a kind of ill will. Right? And, you know, Schadenfreude, right? A bad thing, taking pleasure in the suffering of others. That's the opposite of mudita, taking pleasure in the good fortune of others. I use a phrase once, I was joking with my wife, you know, metta is the Pali word for loving kindness. I think some of us go around practicing anti-metta, like anti-matter, you know, anti-metta. That's ill will. Buddha put a lot of emphasis on that. And he talked about anger with, as he put it, its honeyed barb and poisoned root. Doesn't anger feel like that sometimes? We just want to do it. And it feels weirdly gratifying for a bit. But then that barb is planted, and the poisoned root starts really doing its work for ourselves and for others. You know, as the Buddha has said, as you probably know, getting angry at others is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people get burned. So that's another intention to hold, and it can become quite concrete and real. Ask yourself, you know, who am I at war with? Who am I carrying a grudge about past the point that's helpful? It doesn't mean being a doormat. It doesn't mean being a milquetoast. It doesn't mean forgiving people prematurely. But where am I carrying hot coals around? You know, what are my hot coals? And trying to relinquish those as well. I'll slow down in a minute or two anyway. How about I keep going and then I'll slow down in a minute? Okay. So that's the second of the intentions, is abandoning ill will. A little detail if you want. Actually, obsessive compulsive person that I am, maybe I should abandon that myself. Anyway, relinquishing OCD-ish thoroughness. Anyway, I came up with 21 ways, no less, to turn ill will into goodwill. So I even have a handout to that effect. It's on my website. You could find it. Just go ill will, search on that, rickhansonson.net. There it is, 21 ways, you know, with quotations sometimes from the Buddha. Okay, third noble intention is goodwill. It's not just to abandon ill will, it's to sustain goodwill for toward other people. We don't just hurt them. We don't just carry a grudge in our heart. We don't just harm them. We just don't not harm them, but we actually have their best wishes in our heart. We wake up and we wish them well. I heard a quote recently from the Dalai Lama that stuck in my mind. I'll paraphrase it, although the first part I have exactly. He said, we are only visitors to this planet. At most here for 100 years, and then we're gone. In this time, let's do what we can to bring happiness to ourselves and others. You know, if we focus on our own happiness, we will surely be unhappy. But if we focus on the happiness of others and our own, then we will surely be happy. So, I have a little quote here about the power of loving kindness. Oh yes, good. So, for one who mindfully develops boundless loving kindness, seeing the destruction of clinging, the fetters are worn away. I'm going to read that again. For one who mindfully develops boundless loving kindness, not restricted to my tribe, but omitting none, seeing the destruction of clinging, the fetters are worn away. The fetters is a Buddhist technical term for things like a belief in a self, or clinging to rites and rituals, or attachment to sense pleasures, or ill will toward others, or a wrong view. And those are the fetters, those are the chains. That's what a fetter is, that tie us down and trap us and tie us to the wheel of suffering. Right. It's interesting that there's some recent scholarship, a wonderful book if you have an interest in this kind of thing, What the Buddha Thought, by this Oxford scholar Richard Gombrich. It's got quite a lot of attention in the Buddhist world, and he's really unpacked a lot of what the Buddha really seemed to be thinking and cleaned up some of the old translations. And what's really clear is that the Buddha considered that the path of love was a fully adequate path for full enlightenment. If one took that path of love and perfected it to a sublime degree. That really means that, and there are multiple paths in Buddhism that lead to full awakening. The path of mindfulness and insight can do that, but also the path of love. Isn't that very interesting? The Buddha was a very, very strong advocate of the importance of loving kindness and goodwill toward other beings. Questions or comments so far?
I was just curious if you could say a little bit more about the pleasure centers being lit up when others were suffering. I mean, that's kind of antithetical to how I see the basic.
Well, the pleasure centers can also light up when we see others being happy. But I was just thinking about this study done on people who would, in two steps, first when they were told about a rival who was much more successful, the physical pain centers lit up in their brain as they experienced envy. And then later they were told persuasively, even though it was all made up. It's a classic study. Never believe any researcher in a study or anyone sitting next to you in the waiting room. That's probably a Confederate. But anyway, when they were told that this rival had had a spectacular downfall, the physical pleasure centers lit up too. Now, people vary with that, to be sure. But my point is that it's important to be careful about the tendency in the mind. For many people these days, it's actually really good practice. Pick someone who's got the other political persuasion and wish them well. Wish them true happiness. May you be truly happy. Now, it's really okay to do what I do and add the little quiet thought internally, and then you won't be such a jerk. But, you know, whatever works, intermediately, you know. Oh, I admit it. I don't always say that, but you know, generally speaking, people are truly happy. They tend to, you know, have a bigger heart. But anyway, that's what I would just say about that. So the point is to have these intentions. So right here, you can ask yourself as you mount energy in daily life, okay, what's my energy and what's the next step for me? What's the next good step for me to take in terms of having energy for releasing what's not helpful, whether it's getting cranked up about the clutter in your house, like me, letting go of that one, or releasing, you know, over-perfecting some email or some piece of writing, or releasing, obsessing about what you would have, could have shed and said in that conversation but didn't, you know, or releasing, going over and over some wrong that was done you when the relatives came over the last time, you know, that's a good intention. Or releasing harming others in ways large and small, like having to drive your point home or prove that you're more right, or showing them the error of their ways. Maybe that's worth releasing. And also see if you can mobilize even more of the intention to wish others well. And see what happens when you do. Yeah, Lily, and then I'll keep going.
You know, when you're talking about, what you're saying about, you know, people, parts of their brain light up, you know, when they're being mean, and there are people like that. And, you know, we're sitting here, we're all trying to be Buddhist and be good, but does the Buddhist...
You can be good without being a Buddhist. And keep going.
Right. But I mean, in this room, you know,
we're in that frame.
Right, but there are people that aren't in that frame of mind and do intend harm to us, or you know, just on a personal level, you might meet somebody who's being mean to you, or intentionally. Does the Buddha talk about how do you deal with that?
That's a great question. He did speak a fair amount of. Well, for one, we don't know everything he said, but in the surviving record, which is a pretty good approximation, I've known scholars who, it's probably about 80% a good approximation, which is astonishing. I mean, it's kind of unique. Anyway, he said a few very clear things about the appropriateness of preserving and protecting what was your own, not squandering it. And he talked about the appropriateness of making good plans. That's appropriate. And there are obvious implications. So if someone is trying to steal what's yours, there's a place for finding ways to protect it, including joining with others to protect it. But he didn't go into a lot of detail. He didn't engage the world that much in terms of what to do in the world. Now, with regard to individuals, right. And he's not speaking against things like a justice system or other forms of law or regulation and so forth. He did say, as a person, do not put that other out of your heart. And he said very famously, two monks that came back complaining about being insulted. He said, one who does not sustain boundless loving kindness for various beings is not practicing truly my way. Now there's steps and stages of practicing truly my way, or the Buddha's way. But and then he used the very well-known in Buddhism metaphor, even if bandits were to hold you and saw you savagely, limb by limb, you would still sustain loving kindness for those people. It doesn't mean that anger doesn't arise. It doesn't mean that pain and or the animal desire to pull back or just have the pain stop, for sure, or to protect others from that sort of thing. That's really okay. But to try to hold it in a larger frame in which we ourselves are not polluted or defiled, to use the language that Buddha would use, this strong traditional language, by the dark side of the force, as it were. And there's a famous story, a monk who was finally released from various Chinese government jails. I distinguish between the Chinese government and the Chinese people, obviously, in terms of Tibet. And this monk was routinely tortured, and terrible things happened to him. And so he finally got out after many, many years, and he said to the Dalai Lama, you know, some of the things that had happened to him. And the Dalai Lama asked him, oh my God, at some point, he didn't probably say, oh my God, but you know what I mean. At some point, oh my Tara, oh my Buddha, I don't know. Oh my Avalokiteshvara, something like that. Oh my Shantideva. Anyway, you know, did you ever fear for your life? And the monk replied, he said, only when I felt like I was losing my loving kindness. That's when I feared for my life, quote unquote. That's how he defined his life. Isn't that profound? Now that's pretty far along, right? But that's the practice. And we do it primarily for ourselves. That's the interesting thing. I'll say quite personally, you know, starting, I don't know when, five-ish, not that great on locating things in longer periods of time, five-ish years ago, I really took on the practice of never speaking or acting out of anger. And I picked it up initially with my kids, and I was always a pretty mellow dad, but when I relinquished that in an absolute way, I was astonished at how I started to detect molecules of irritability leaking through, sometimes whole rivers of them, you know. And I think it's quite powerful to actually pick something. Another great one is fear, is to work with anxiety. Another classic one is shame, inadequacy. You know, that's another great one. To really, it arises, but to not enact it. And with time, to remove the fuel for it. The Buddha, again and again and again and again, used the metaphor fundamentally of fuel. Whether it was physical fuel, logs on a fire, the fires of the passions, of greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion, later described as poisons, or what he called the nutriments, the fertilizer, if you will, of unwholesome states of mind, harmful ways of being. It's all about the fuel. You know, the fires are burning. We're all in the middle of fires burning. One of his very first teachings was the fire sermon, essentially, the fire sutta. And he talked about the fuels. Well, it's very interesting to practice with one thing for a while, like anger, including very, very subtle anger, including just anger in the mind, and see what it's like to try to gradually disengage from it, not enact it, and find ways of stepping away from it. I found for myself, when I really did that, and I've been sustaining that practice still, it made me a better man, better parent, better husband, better guy, better human. It forced me to speak more from my heart. It forced me to slow down. And it actually forced me to stop sputtering and start taking certain things more seriously. You know, if we take care of the big things, we're going to get less angry about the little ones. All right? And you might think about something like that for yourself. Okay. Then on to the last thing I want to talk about, where we bring energy, is to the four efforts, or wise effort. You may recall that in the Noble Eightfold Path, there's wise effort. What are the wise efforts of wise effort? They are to prevent harmful states of a mind from arising, or to decrease or abandon them if they do arise. In other words, we want to pull weeds, as it were, or prevent the weeds in the garden of the mind. And the other two of the four wise efforts are to create wholesome, positive mental factors, like kindness, or mindfulness, or investigation, or energy, or being on one's own side, or self-compassion. We are to create these, and ideally, to preserve them and even increase them once they're present in the mind. Those are the four efforts. That's what we do. And, you know, when everything's going fine, cool. But if you find yourself irritated, or caught in a wrangle with somebody, or mopey, or really worried about something, it's a very helpful quick inventory. Okay. what's helpful or unhelpful, wholesome or unwholesome, loving or unloving, or contracted or relaxed and open, released, or liberated or tangled. The Buddha also used often the language of tangled, being tangled. Right? What's tangled up versus what's liberated? So a moment, and then look and see, what could I do to stop adding fuel to the fire of the unwholesome, the negative, the unhelpful, the tangled, the contracted factors in my mind right now? For example, can I just take a shower? Can I interrupt this grumbling stream? Can I shift gears to something that's more positive? Can I be strong with myself? Can I remind myself that this is not helping? This is burning me. Okay? Can I prevent this? Can I stop adding fuel? And then, can I do little things? Not repressing my emotions, but little things to encourage the negative to subside. Right? Yeah, I'll finish this little bit, then I'll do that. The other thing is, when I notice what's happening in my mind, are there positive factors present? If not, what can I bring to mind? We can always bring mindfulness to a situation. We can always step back and observe. What am I experiencing? What's happening right now? What is this right now? What is this in the body right now? What are the sensations? What are the emotions right now? What are the attitudes right now? You know, what's the point of view or perspective right now? Okay? That's mindfulness. That's a positive factor of mind. Right? We can stop doing harm. We can increase self-control. Or maybe we notice positive factors present, like a sense of advocacy for ourselves, for what's really important. Or a dawning understanding of the other person. The last physical fight I was ever in was in my mid-20s in Germany in this very odd personal growth organization that shall be nameless for the moment. And no one's ever heard of it as it should be. But anyway, and this guy, Gil, and I, you know, he shoved me, I shoved him, he hit me, I hit him back. That was it. We're yelling at each other full force. And we had done a lot of inner work, so full force was full force, and for better and for worse. And I'll tell you, I had the funniest experience. So we were yelling at each other, spits flying from my mouth, and he hit me in the mouth, so I was bleeding a little bit. It was very real. And I saw in his face this fleck of blood, this dot of blood, spot of blood. And I had the oddest experience. In full force rage, full on, okay, two large male mammals yelling at each other, you know, 2 feet apart, I had the strongest impulse to very tenderly reach out and wipe that bit of blood off his face. Even in the midst of all that, you know, the human animal still wanted to do that. I can't claim ownership of that. I'm not claiming any virtue. It arose. It wasn't like I thought, gee, I want to be a better man. You know, it just arose in the midst of all that. That would be a wholesome factor of mine. So that's what we do with wise effort. Yeah? Oh, yeah, we have to exercise energy.
This is obvious.
Yeah, to make an effort. Yeah, to imagine pushing a ball down a road. We have to engage energy to do that. Or imagine trying to stop a ball that's rolling downhill toward us. Again, we engage energy to do that. Now, certain things help us engage energy. It's interesting, there are these four things to think about in Tibet. They're called the mind changers. And these are the four, the classic four things to think about. One is the preciousness of a human life. With or without a belief in reincarnation, first, I don't know about you, I'd rather be a human than a mosquito. I'd rather be a human than a cow being raised for hamburger meat. And I'd rather be alive today than 200 years ago. This is a far from perfect world, but I'm a big believer in, you know, Novocaine, refrigeration, antibiotics, I think space travel is kind of cool. I like satellites. ESPN, one of the great inventions, you know, the internet.